Okay, welcome to the 89th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. My name is Divine. I'm a PGY1, a transitional year resident going into radiology. And into this podcast, we're going to be continuing our discussion of neuro for step one. So this will be the second part in the series. This podcast will be mainly a teaching podcast. I mean, I will introduce some case scenarios along the way, but it will mostly be a teaching podcast because I want to use this podcast to lay a foundation for many questions I'll be able to create in the future for the other neuro podcasts. So let's begin. And really, today I'm just really going to spend a lot of time talking about the autonomic nervous system, right? I mean, the autonomic nervous system, we already know it's divided into the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems, right? And many of you have learned that, oh, it's a two-neuron system. And really, it is a two-neuron system. That's what you should remember for your exam. But the truth is, if you really want to get down and dirty, your autonomic nervous system is actually a three-neuron system. So those two neurons, there's actually a neuron that comes before it in the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is ultimately the origin of your autonomic nervous system. I'll talk about that in a future podcast and sort of make some references to that today. So your autonomic nervous system, I mean, what does it do? Basically controls like smooth muscle, not skeletal muscle. Skeletal muscle is mostly under the control of your somatic nervous system. But your smooth muscle, your cardiac muscle, for example, your glands, like your sweat glands, for example, those are all under the control of your autonomic nervous system. And like I said, right, we have the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems. And I mean, again, if you're going with the classic mantra of the two-neuron system, we have like a preganglionic neuron. Basically, between those two neurons, the preganglionic and postganglionic, right? You can see preganglion prior to ganglion, postganglion after ganglion. So that means a ganglion must sort of like be in the way, right? Between preganglionic and postganglionic. And the thing is, those preganglionic neurons, right? They all arise from a neural tube because their cell bodies are all found in the central nervous system, right? Like, for example, you classically hear people say that, oh, instead of doing that to confuse you even further, just believe what I say, that the preganglionic, because I will have to go off on this huge tangent if I want to explain some other stuff, but let's just say that the preganglionic neurons, the cell bodies are all in the central nervous system, so guess what, they're all derived from neural tube, okay? But the postganglionic neurons, right, their cell bodies actually found outside the central nervous system in ganglia. Okay, so because the cell bodies are found in ganglia, guess what? Those things actually derive from neural crest. Okay, so very high yield to know this. Your postganglionic autonomic nervous system neurons are all derived from neural crest. In fact, if you look at the adrenal medulla, right? Remember, I said in the earlier podcast that the adrenal medulla is a modified postganglionic sympathetic ganglion, basically. So those chromaffin cells of the adrenal medulla, right, are actually all derived from neural crest. In fact, a very nice way they can test that is to test the pheochromocytoma, right? So like a patient presenting with like episodic headache and hypertension, and then they tell you like what's the embryologic origin of the cells that play a role in this disorder, right? Those will be your neural crest cells, okay? Your adrenal medullary chromaffin cells. Remember, the adrenal medulla is very different embryologically from the adrenal cortex. And if you want to look at all the preganglionic neurons as a whole, right? Basically, all of them secrete acetylcholine, okay? So the preganglionic neurons, they squirt out acetylcholine. That acetylcholine acts on receptors that we find on the surface of the postganglionic neurons, okay? And the acetylcholine receptors specifically that we find on the surfaces of postganglionic neurons are nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, okay? So acetylcholine released by the preganglionic neuron acts on the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors that are found on the postganglionic neurons, okay? And then those postganglionic neurons fire and then do all this fun stuff, okay? But one key thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is that those postganglionic neurons, depending on if you're talking about the sympathetic nervous system or the parasympathetic nervous system, they do totally different things, right? So for example, for your parasympathetic nervous system, the postganglionic neurons actually release acetylcholine as well, okay? They release acetylcholine. But the thing is, the target organ, right? So like the target smooth muscle, the target cardiac muscle, the target glands that receive that innervation, okay? They actually have muscarinic acetylcholine receptors on their surfaces, okay? So parasympathetic nervous system, postganglionic neuron secretes acetylcholine, acts on muscarinic acetylcholine receptors that we find in the target organs. But in the sympathetic system, we actually have two variations on that theme, right? So there are actually parts of the sympathetic nervous system that where the postganglionic neurons release acetylcholine to act on target organ muscarinic receptors. The big one you want to know for your exam is sweat gland, right? Your sweat glands actually do not receive parasympathetic innervation, okay? Your sweat glands primarily receive sympathetic innervation, okay? And that postganglionic sympathetic neuron secretes acetylcholine to act on muscarinic receptors on the surfaces of the sweat glands, okay? But the remaining adrenergic neurons, right? So the postganglionic sympathetic neurons, many of them secrete catecholamines, right? So like norepinephrine and epinephrine, okay? To act on target adrenergic receptors, which include alpha receptors, beta receptors, and whatnot. And again, don't forget, your adrenal medulla is a modified postganglionic sympathetic neuron, okay? So those cells also have nicotinic acetylcholine receptors on their surfaces, right? So again, I would highly recommend you know those. I mean, I just talked earlier, I mentioned skeletal muscle and your somatic nervous system. The thing is, skeletal muscle, right, it's more of a one neuron system. Again, everyone calls it a one neuron system, and that's what you should remember for your exam. But again, that is not exactly true, right? Because if you really think about it, right, those neurons, right, those alpha motor neurons that you find in the ventral horn of the spinal cord, right? Yeah, it's one neuron that goes to your muscular junction, and they release acetylcholine that acts on nicotinic receptors on the surfaces of skeletal muscle. And actually notes that those nicotinic receptors are actually different from the nicotinic receptors we find on the surfaces of the postganglionic autonomic nervous system neurons. But the thing is, those alpha motor neurons of the ventral horn of the spinal cord, they actually also receive innervation from the corticospinal tract, right? An upper motor neuron that comes from the corticospinal tract. If you want to be a little more specific, that'll be the precentral gyrus of the cerebral cortex. So let's sort of talk about these branches a little more, right? So I guess we can talk about the parasympathetic nervous system first, right? So parasympathetic, you've probably heard of this boss phrase, craniosacral, that, oh, it has craniosacral outflow, blah, 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 blah. What do they mean by that? The things they mean by that are that certain cranial nerves, right, actually constitute a part of your parasympathetic, they carry like some parasympathetic nervous system fibers, okay? And then certain sacral spinal nerves also carry parasympathetic nerve fibers, right? So and actually, again, just make sure that everything is clear to you here. These cranial nerves and these sacrospinal nerves, okay, I'm basically discussing them as postganglionic parasympathetic neurons, okay? So all these things are all derived from, guess what, neural crest, okay? Very high yield to know that. So like cranial nerves 3, 7, 9, and 10, okay, those all carry parasympathetic nerve fibers. And then your sacral spinal nerves 2 to 4, okay, carry parasympathetic and nerve fibers as well. So cranial nerve 3, right, I mean, like if you want to constrict your pupil to have meiosis, or you want to sort of like adjust the shape of your lens with your ciliary muscles, those are all under the purview of cranial 3's parasympathetic functions. If you're looking at cranial 7's parasympathetic functions, right, so like the glands that help you make saliva, right, so like your sublingual glands, your submandibular glands, even the glands in your nasal mucosa, right, and also the glands that make you cry, your lacrimal glands, let's think more tears of joy, I guess, than tears of sorrow. So the glands that make you have tears of joy, your lacrimal glands, they're all under the control of the parasympathetic functions of cranial nerve 7. And then if you're looking at cranial nerve 9, it really doesn't do much in parasympathetic territory. The big one you want to remember for step 1 are the parotid glands. The parotid glands actually innervated by cranial nerve 9, okay, the glossopharyngeal nerve. And then cranial 10 does pretty much every other thing. It's a wandering nerve, does pretty much every other thing all the way to the splenic flexure, okay? That's like in the left upper quadrant. Remember, vagus nerve, again, outside of the face, the vagus nerve does pretty much every parasympathetic thing up until the splenic flexure. If you want to parasympathetically innervate your hindgut, and like your bladder, right? So, and also like sort of like control like erection. Remember, your parasympathetic system actually controls erection. That's where the sacral part of the cranial sacral outflow of your parasympathetic system comes into play. So S2 to S4, okay? That's where they come in. And I mean, like I said, all these neurons, right? All these cranials, 3, 7, 9, 10, and whatnot, they are all derived from neural crest. And remember, the neural crest, for it to accomplish its objectives, as I discussed in the first part of this series, I said that those neurons have to migrate, right? If they don't migrate right, you can get into a lot of trouble, right? For example, Down syndrome is really just a neural crest cell migration problem, right? So for example, Down syndrome is associated with Hirschsprung's disease, right? In Hirschsprung's disease, you don't have, you basically don't have neurons, right, in the ganglia that constitute, especially like in the rectum or like your lower like colon, right? So that's how the person gets into trouble, right? That's those neurons in those ganglia, they all derive from neural crest cells. So if your neural crest cells don't migrate well, they get into trouble. If you look at, the endocardial cushion defects that accompany Down syndrome, right? Those endocardial cushions, the aortico-pulmonary septum and whatnot, what do you think they're all derived from? Guess what? They're all derived from neural crest. So again, if you have neural crest cell migration problems, you can get cardiac problems. So one thing I'll just say is the disparate series of symptoms you seem to observe in people that have Down syndrome, those things actually explained if you just sort of think about the different things that are derived from neural crest, right? And then ask yourself, oh, if this person's neural crest cells don't migrate well, what can happen? Okay. And then many of the findings in Down syndrome will begin to make a little more sense to you. So your parasympathetic system, cranial sacral, right? So what's the buzz phrase for the sympathetic nervous system, right? That's thoracolumbar, right? So thoracolumbar outflow. The thoraco part is like T1 to T12, and then the lumbar part is L1 to L2, okay? And the thing is, your sympathetic nervous system, for the most part, has short preganglionic neurons and long postganglionic neurons versus your parasympathetic system that has long preganglionic neurons and short postganglionic neurons. The easy way to remember that is to remember one part of it, right? If you just remember what obtains for one part of the autonomic nervous system, then the other one, you just know it's the other one, right? So I give you an example, right? So one way I remember this is I remember that the sympathetic nervous system, for some bizarre reason, loves to deal with paravertebral ganglia, okay? Paravertebral ganglia. So let's deconstruct that term, paravertebral. Paravertebral means literally next to the vertebral bodies, okay? Those sympathetic chain ganglia, they're also known as paravertebral ganglia. So think about it. If your sympathetic nervous system is thoracolumbar outflow and the preganglionic neuron is starting in the spinal cord from T1 to T12 or L1 to L2 and just has to travel to a ganglion that is right next to the spinal cord, that is right next to the vertebral bodies, it won't have to travel a long distance, right? If you remember that one fact, you can then basically create the rest of the information. I mean, I think I may have mentioned this in one of my prior, like, how to study sort of deal podcasts. But basically, try to learn the least amount of information that will allow you to control the most amount of information. That is how smart people learn, right? So if you remember that paravertebral ganglion factoid, you know that, okay, well, that means the preganglionic neuron in the sympathetic nervous system does not have to travel that far. So it has to be short. And then from that, you can deduce that, okay, that means the postganglionic neuron has to travel a long distance. So it has to be long. And then if you know that a parasympathetic nervous system is basically the opposite of the sympathetic nervous system, you can basically take opposites of everything and boom, you remember all that people make flashcards and all that crap to try to remember. So we have those paravertebral ganglia. Okay, they are basically like they essentially have a lot of postganglionic sympathetic cell bodies, okay, that ultimately go to like sweat glands in the body and all that stuff, okay? And let's see. Actually, one other high yield thing I think I want to mention with your sympathetic nervous system is this thing known as the superior cervical ganglion, right? So the thing is, your sympathetic nervous system, right? I basically think of it as doing two sets of things. It does your body and your face / head, okay? So your body is done primarily by the paravertebral ganglia based postganglionic sympathetic neurons, but your face and your head, okay, are done mostly by your superior cervical ganglion based postganglionic sympathetic neurons. So what do I mean by that? So let me sort of talk through this, right? So I said that your sympathetic nervous system is thoracolumbar outflow, right? So the thing is, your T1 spinal nerves, okay, your T1 spinal nerves basically can have some preganglionic sympathetic neurons that ascend and go all the way to the superior cervical ganglion that's found in the neck, okay? And then from the superior cervical ganglion, we have postganglionic sympathetic neurons that then go and accomplish many things in the head and neck. I mean, I can give you some examples, right? So, for example, some smooth muscles in the eye, right? So, like your dilator pupillae muscles, right? So, remember, if you're running from a lion, you don't want to like squint your eyes. I mean, if you squint your eyes, I mean, maybe the next time you open it up, you'll be in the belly of the lion, right? Which is probably not an ideal outcome. But if you're running away from a lion, your eyes have to be like wide open, right? So your eyes have to be wide open and your eyelids have to be elevated as much as possible. So for your eyelids to be wide open, you need pupillary dilators to make that happen. And if you want your eyelids to be wide open, you need something that elevates the eyelid. Okay, and if you want to be a little more specific, that is your superior tarsal muscle. Your superior tarsal muscle is an elevator of the eyelid. Okay, so it helps you elevate your eyelid so that you can run away from said lion. Although, something that's kind of like a weird thing there is your levator palpebrae superioris, your LPS muscle. It's actually an elevator of your eyelid as well. But it's actually not innervated by your parasympathetic nervous system, but it's actually innervated by cranial nerve 3. So people may say, come on, Divine, what are you saying? This is not making any sense. Remember that cranial nerve 3 has parasympathetic functions, but it also has its own somatic functions. One of the somatic functions of cranial 3, the oculomotor nerve, is to innervate the levator palpebrae superioris, which also elevates your eyelid. Okay, but cranial 3 has parasympathetic functions that include like your pupillary sphincters, I mean your pupillary constrictors and your ciliary muscles, right? So your ciliary muscles that help you adjust the shape of the lens for accommodation. So your pupillary dilators, superior tarsal muscles, right? Those are all innervated by postganglionic sympathetic neurons emanating from the superior superior cervical ganglion. But the thing is, from the superior cervical ganglion, right, a person can basically have like those postganglionic sympathetic neurons. They sort of take like sort of like a circuitous course through the brain, right? So it's actually kind of high yield to know that they actually sort of encircle the internal carotid arteries on their way to structures in the face. Because if you really think about it, if a person has like a carotid dissection, right, where classically they were presented on an exam as a person that went to a chiropractor for like a neck massage, or a person that was like maybe brushing their teeth forcefully, and then they have a dissection of the carotid arteries, that can actually involve the fibers that are emanating from the superior cervical ganglion, and the person will basically have a Horner syndrome, right? So they will have ptosis, right? So they'll have a droopy eyelid because the superior tarsal muscle is not working. They will have meiosis because the pupillary constrictors will be working unopposed because the pupillary dilators are no longer working. And they will have anhidrosis because remember I said that your sympathetic nervous system, some of the postganglionic sympathetic neurons release acetylcholine that acts on muscarinic receptors on sweat glands, okay? So if you have lesions of those postganglionic sympathetic neurons, guess what? You will not release acetylcholine. And that, since you're not releasing acetylcholine, there's nothing to activate the muscarinic receptors that you find on the surfaces of your sweat glands in the face. So the person will have anhidrosis, okay? So that's essentially the pathophysiology behind the ptosis, meiosis, and anhidrosis that is observed in Horner's syndrome. And it's actually very high yield to know this, that Horner's syndrome is usually, in fact, I would say on MBM, it is always ipsilateral, okay? It is always ipsilateral to where you have the problem. So that is one potential cause of a Horner syndrome, right? So if you have a lesion, like a dissection of the carotid arteries. Another thing that can cause a Horner syndrome, right, can be like something called like a cervical rib, right? So most of your ribs emanate from like your, for the most part, come from your thoracic vertebra, right? But if for some bizarre reason you have a rib that comes from one of your cervical vertebra, that's very high up, right? That can potentially pierce the fibers that are on the way to the superior cervical ganglion, okay? And that can cause Horner syndrome as well. But that'll be more of a preganglionic sympathetic nerve defect. Another classic cause of Horner syndrome, right? Again, I'm just basically trying to give you all the different ways they can test Horner syndrome on your exam. If a person has a Pankos tumor, right, that's also called like a superior sulcus tumor. So it's like a tumor that you find in the upper, like very high up in the lung. That can also compress the preganglionic sympathetic nerve fibers that are going to the superior cervical ganglion, okay? And that can also cause a Horner syndrome. And then another thing that may cause a Horner syndrome is if you have a lateral brainstem problem, right? Because remember I said that everyone regards the autonomic nervous system as a two-neuron system. And that is certainly what you should learn for exams. But remember I said that that is not really true. I said that many of those fibers, I mean, your sympathetic nervous system, in fact, your autonomic nervous system, okay, both sympathetic, parasympathetic, whatever, they both start in the hypothalamus. So the thing is, those hypothalamic fibers that descend from the brain and come all the way to the spinal cord to hit like your thoracolumbar spinal nerves, okay, for example, in the sympathetic nervous system, those hypothalamic fibers, they actually come down in the lateral brainstem, okay? They come down in the lateral brainstem. So if you have like a problem with like a pica, right? I think that's what's known as like your posterior inferior cerebellar artery. If you have a pica infarct, I think that's what they call Wallenberg syndrome. You can essentially infarct your lateral medulla, right? Or if you have like an ICA problem, you can infarct your lateral pons, okay? Those people will have something called a central Horner syndrome, right? They'll have a central Horner syndrome. And it will present with the ptosis, meiosis, and hydrosis and whatnot. But here's where your friends at the MBME can get sneaky, sneaky, right? The thing is, if a person has Horner syndrome, right, usually they just have ptosis, meiosis, and hydrosis. Horner syndrome basically from the other causes, right? So like the Pankos tumor or the carotid artery dissection or the thoracic outlet syndrome with like the cervical rib. But if you have an infarct of your lateral brain stem, right, in addition to the Horner syndrome, the ipsilateral Horner syndrome, guess what? You also have like contralateral problems with pain and temperature sensation from the body. And you may say, Divine, why is that? Well, guess what? Is there any other spinal tract that for some reason travels in the lateral brainstem, right? I really hope you're telling me about the spinal thalamic tract. Your spinal thalamic tract travels in the lateral brainstem. And remember, it's already decussated at the level of the anterior white commissure before it ascends in the lateral brainstem. So guess what? If you have an infarct of pica, you have an ipsilateral Horner syndrome because the lateral brainstem is screwed. You have a contralateral spinal thalamic tract lesion. And you would also potentially have like problems with certain cranial nerves, right? Like you may have like cranial 9, cranial 10 problems, cranial 8 problems, okay? So those are kind of like high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. If you see like pain and temperature loss on the contralateral side, ipsilateral Horner syndrome, well, you see things more along the lines of like, oh, they cannot, the lacrimal glands don't work, or they have like a Bell's palsy, right? Then you're thinking more about an AICA infarct, okay? That's a lateral pontine lesion, okay? All these lesions, I'm going to revisit them again in future podcasts, but I'm sort of giving you a preview of coming attractions, if you may. Now, let's see, is there any other thing I want to say about the sympathetic nervous system? I think that's all I want to say. I mean, this will probably be my shortest neuro podcast because neuro is just a big subject in and of itself. But, I mean, let's see, are there any other things I can add to this short podcast? Well, I guess we can real quick talk about, like, your glial cells, right? This is super easy. Glial cells, they're like support cells in the nervous system. We can have like the Schwann cells, right? Remember, Schwann cells can myelinate only one axon, and they are the cells that are attacked in Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? And remember, your Schwann cells actually come from neurocrest, right? Contrast that with your oligodendrocytes. A single oligodendrocyte can myelinate multiple axons, right? And your oligodendrocytes, again, come from neurotube. They don't come from neurocrest. And remember that oligodendrogliomas, right? They have like that classic fried egg appearance when you do on histology, right? So fried egg appearance, your schwannomas, remember, a person can have like multiple schwannomas, especially in the setting of neurofibromatosis type 2, right? Like bilateral acoustic neuromas, those are actually schwannomas. You may say, Divine, come on. Schwannomas, we usually find them at the cerebellopontine angle. Okay, that's a great thought. But remember I said your cranial nerves are derived from what? From neural crest. With what exception? Cranial 2, right? Remember, cranial 2, your optic nerve is actually derived from the diencephalon, okay? So, which is derived from your prosencephalon. Remember those primary, secondary vesicles I talked about in the prior podcast. So, your cranial nerves are derived from the peripheral nervous system. So guess what? They are innervated by, they are myelinated by things that come from, guess what? The peripheral nervous system. Like what? Your Schwann cells, okay? So that's why you can have schwannomas in the brain, okay? Not all myelination that you find in the, like above the neck, has to be from oligodendrocytes, okay? It can also be from Schwann cells because your cranial nerves, with the exception of cranial 2, are all derived from neural crest, okay? So again, super, 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 super high yield to understand these things. That's why you see me going into all this trouble to explain, right? Again, you can just memorize stuff or you can understand. If you understand it, when you get those questions that 90-95% of people get wrong, you'll be able to weasel your way through those because you just have this detailed understanding of what's going on. And then don't forget your astrocytes, right? Your astrocytes, they basically help with maintaining like the blood-brain barrier. So that's kind of important to know. We have like many kinds of astrocytomas, like GBM, right? So like glioblastoma multiforme is a kind of astrocytoma, but that's something you probably won't see on your exam. Don't forget your ependymal cells, right? Remember, your ependymal cells actually like line your ventricles, right? Although you want to be careful, there is actually a type of cell that is derived from your ependymal cell. It's known as a choroid plexus cell. Those choroid plexus cells are the cells that make CSF. They are derived from ependymal cells, but they're actually like their own cell type. Choroid plexus cells, they make CSF. But the thing is, if you want to circulate that CSF, you need like cilia, right? And ependymal cells have cilia that they use to essentially circulate CSF. And then don't forget your microglia. They are not derived from ectoderm, right? They're actually derived from mesoderm, okay? They're like the CNS macrophages. And the thing is, for some reason, the HIV virus loves to infect microglia, right? So a person can get like reactive gliosis in the setting of HIV infection. And then, your neurons, I guess I can also talk about the things that come from neurocrest cells, right? So I've sort of talked about many of them in the prior podcast and many of them in this, like the early part of this podcast. But don't forget things like your postganglionic autonomic nervous system neurons, your chromaffin cells of the adrenal medulla, right? Your melanocytes, right? Your melanocytes. That's why many of these some skin tumors being like S100 positive. Your melanocytes come from neural crest. Your pia matter, your arachnoid matter, those are together known as the leptomeninges. Leptomeninges, I believe, is your pia and arachnoid. Pachymeninges, I believe, is your dura and arachnoid. But leptomeninges, pia, arachnoid, they both come from neurocrest. Your Schwann cells, your odontoblasts that help you make teeth, they all come from neurocrest, okay? Your C cells, your clear cells, right? Your parafollicular cells, also that help you make those help you make calcitonin. Yes, your parafollicular cells, they help you make calcitonin. They are all derived from neurocrest. They're all derived from neurocrest. So again, super, super high yield to know the things that come from neurocrest, right? So again, your C cells, remember calcitonin helps you calcitone down your blood calcium, okay? They're all derived from neurocrest cells. And then what if they give you a question about a child that has like bitemporal hemianopsia, so basically like tunnel vision, right? And then they tell you that, oh, they do imaging of the head, like a CT scan of the head, and they find like a suprastellar mass that is calcified. And then let's say they tell you that, oh, when they do a biopsy or whatever, they see like motor oil looking fluid emanating from the mass, right? That's actually not motor oil, it's more like cholesterol, but hopefully you're thinking about a craniopharyngioma. They love to test it in the context of it's an embryological like derivation, right, from like a Ratke's pouch, okay? Remember, that's like a fancy name for like oral ectoderm, okay? So something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And don't forget that your pituitary gland, right? Obviously, you know your pituitary has two parts, anterior and posterior pituitary. Your posterior pituitary actually comes from neuroectoderm, right? So like neurotube. But your anterior pituitary actually comes from Radke's pouch. Okay, so again, just one of those weird high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Let's see, I guess maybe I could stop here. You know what, just real quick, I promise, 2 more minutes. I mean, a neuron, I'm just trying to think of the things that first aid covers, like a neuron, right? Has like a cell buddy, has a, I think it's known as like the soma. And then remember, neuron is a kind of cell, right? So it should be able to make protein, right? So we actually have like rough endoplasmic reticula in neurons. It's known as like nasal substance. That's where you basically make like neurotransmitters. Remember, neurotransmitters are kind of protein. And then you can move those neurotransmitters to the synapse, right? You can move them from the soma or the cell body of the neuron to the synapse by using like anti-grade transport. Don't forget that that's done by kinesin. That's something that actually shows up a ton on the USMLEs. That's something you definitely want to know. I believe I've actually mentioned this in one of my cell physiology podcasts from back in the day. So anti-grade transport, that's done by kinesin. Retrograde, if you want to go from like, oh, if you want to go from the synapse all the way back to the cell body, you do that with dynein. Okay, you do that with dynein. So you may say, Divine, why is this necessary, right? I already said that, oh, anti-grade transport helps you move neurotransmitter. Fine. The thing is that retrograde transport, it's good, but it's also bad, right? So, I mean, how do you think like viruses like, I don't know, like polio or like rabies or like even like the tetanus like toxin or like VZV that sort of hangs out in the trigeminal ganglion? How do you think those things go from... How do you think those things, like you get the infection and then it goes and hangs out in cell bodies? How do you think that happens? Happens through retrograde transport, okay? So that's why it's high yield to know that. So just something to keep at the back of your mind. And remember, right, your kinesin, dynein, right, these are all like microtubular structures. So I think that's where I'm going to stop, as I always end with. I do offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, and Step 3. I also do like application advising. So if you're a med student going into med school, so like AMCAS applications or interview prep and all that crap, or if you're a if you're a college student going to med school, or if you're a med student going to residency, right? So like ERAS applications, I do like consulting and whatnot for that. I mean, I've been on the admissions committee of a top 3 med school, so I have a lot of experience with that stuff, like interview prep, writing personal statements and all that fun stuff. And then if you have like shelf exams or preclinical exams that you need to study for, I also offer private tutoring for those. And then weirdly, if you need tutoring for organic chemistry, especially synthesis, I am an expert at stuff like that. So I can help you with that. And again, I have a lot of free resources on my... Everything on my website is free, right? So don't forget your shelf exams, step 1, step 3, internal medicine exams. There's many, many, many free podcasts and videos on my website. So please share, spread the word, and I will see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful day and God bless you.